Well, good morning. Thanks for joining us. You know, Lindsay mentioned it on the video, but if this is the first time you've come or one of the first times you've walked in, we do appreciate you doing that. I know sometimes it's hard to walk into a new place. And if you're joining us online, thanks also for being with us. So we are taking or encouraging you to take this devotional that we have for free, one per family unit, because we want to slow down a little bit between now and Christmas. Advent season, it's a time to reflect. Jesus came to earth. It was a time of preparation for God's people. I think, again, to reflect on the significance of that. And also the hope that he's going to come back one day. There's a second coming of Jesus, and we believe that is reason for hope. As I mentioned, this devotional, Darkness Than Light, Jonathan Sage wrote an article, they're about two pages, called So Shall It Be. And in this, he talks about he and his wife going in for the first ultrasound of their unborn child to find out that there were six cloudy spots that could have been cysts on the child's brain. And the doctor said, well, it could be one of two things, and the way it would go is the child would be born and pass away within a year, or the child would be born and she'll be fine. Turned out the second option happened, the child was born and fine, but they didn't know that. There was one test to determine how that might go, but it would endanger the child's life in the womb, so the parents decided, we're not doing that. So they spent the duration, 6 or 7 months, waiting and hoping. And in that, he wrote this, no one whose hope is in the Lord is ever put to shame. We rest in the goodness of him who keeps all his promises. But you didn't know. You didn't know how that was going to go. You didn't know if your child would live or die within the first year. And yet he wrote, no one whose hope is in the Lord is ever put to shame. We rest in the goodness of him who keeps all his promises. That's a brash hope. That's a stubborn hope. That said, I believe God is above any circumstance. I believe God is above any outcome. Seriously, can we live with that kind of hope? I think we can, and I think it's really rooted in what happened at Christmas. So I want to talk about that this morning. So you got a Bible? If you'd open it to Isaiah chapter 42, verses 1 through 9, we're going to go through this passage and wrestle with the question, what's the hope of Christmas? What's the hope of Christmas? As you're turning there, let me just set the stage of the book of Isaiah, written about 700 years before Jesus was born. The first 39 chapters of Isaiah are really a bummer. Because through the prophet Isaiah, God says, you're going to be going to captivity. Babylon's going to come. They're going to destroy your city. They're going to sack the temple, ruin the temple. And you're going to live in refugees because you have been living in disobedience. You've been following false gods. That's a letdown. 39 chapters of that, more or less. But chapter 40, there's a change. It says, comfort, oh, comfort my people, said the Lord. And he lays out a hope that though the 70 years of captivity will happen, he's going to raise up a deliverer, and he will actually name him Cyrus, the king of Persia, who will allow the people to go back. And we believe that servant is a type of a greater servant who was to come, and that is Jesus. And with that backdrop, let me read then Isaiah 42, verse 1. It says, behold connects chapter 42 to what's been said in chapters 40 and 41. Behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. At Jesus' baptism, God spoke from heaven, and this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. We believe this is a paraphrase, a clear reference to Isaiah 42. Citing this is firmly a prophetic verse that ultimately looks forward to Jesus. He said, I put my spirit upon him, and he will bring forth justice to the nations. Justice to the nations. What is that? Well, certainly it includes making us just with God because Jesus dies in our place. But it's more than kind of redistributing things so the world is fair. This is a movement of God that brings life the way it was supposed to be lived. See, we're all created to live under God's leadership and direction, but we went our own way and did our own thing, and that has caused all kinds of chaos. If you don't believe that, take a brief course in world history. But I'm going to return, Jesus said, order the way it's supposed to be. You think about that. Let's say a decision is made. We're going to reallocate money from here to here. Somebody's not happy. Somebody's going to complain. We're going to change taxes here to fund this. Somebody's not happy. Somebody's going to complain. Somebody supports that. Somebody doesn't. This is going to be a movement of God that is going to bring life the way he designed it. God's life-giving order. And Jesus is going to be the catalyst of that. And so verses 2 and 3 look forward to this one who is going to be the catalyst, who is going to bring that life-giving order. He says he will not cry out or raise his voice, nor make his voice heard in the street. If you pay attention to politics today, everybody's trying to have the loudest voice. Who can control the news cycle? Who can be heard? Who can literally sometimes shout the other person down? That ain't going to be how Jesus rolls. He's going to have a pretty quiet voice. In his actions, a bruised reed he will not break. Reeds were really thin, and if you could step on them, you could snap them real quickly. Jesus won't do that. And a dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. How easy would it be for me to lick my finger and just put that out? Jesus would be so under control, he won't even do that. Seriously, this guy's not going to shout people down. He's not going to beat people down. And yet it says he will faithfully bring forth justice. How is he going to do that? One of the descriptors in the scripture of Jesus is that he was gentle. Gentle means literally power under control. So we've been working our way through the book of Luke, and Jesus went back to his hometown. He said some things that upset the people, and they took him right to the edge of the cliff, and they were going to throw him over. He says, nope, not today, and he just walked through. That's power. Were you going to throw me over the cliff? Nope, not today. He just walked through. Later in Luke, we'll see that he's caught in a storm. The disciples going to think they're going to perish, and Jesus stands up and says, hush, be still. That's the end of the storm. Then he'll encounter a demon-possessed guy who nobody could control. With the word, Jesus cast those demons out. Next, he'll see a little girl who's passed away, and people are mourning, and he will say, child, arise, and the child will come back to life. That's power, friends. But it's under control. Here's what it says about Jesus in verse 4. He will not be disheartened or crushed until he has established justice in the earth. This is going to happen. And the coastlands will wait expectantly for his law. Now notice, Jesus came gently first time. There's a second time he's coming back, and this is what it says it's going to be like in Revelation 19. At the end of the age, Jesus will turn. This is how it goes. And I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on his is called faithful and true, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems. And he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. He is clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. From his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the wine press of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. And on his robe and on his thigh, he has his name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Jesus will come back one day, and he will set things in order. And any opposition will be put down. But for now, Jesus works quietly, gently, establishing his kingdom as people willingly give their life to him, and the church and God's people begin to move that kingdom forward. That movement started at Christmas 2,000 years ago and will culminate when Jesus returns. See, we started by asking this question, what's the hope of Christmas? Here's what I'd say. Christmas signals the start of the reinstatement of God's life-giving order. 2,000 years ago, signaled the start. God is on the move of the reinstatement of God's life-giving order. One of my first seminary professors, this is 1984, described an injury. He was playing softball, and they thought it was a fun game, and took out his knee and tore his anterior cruciate ligament. Now, this is before modern medicine, where you could fix that arthroscopically, and it was a major surgery. They cut here and went all the way down. You were in a brace. There was a stimulator. It was months. A major operation. And he talked about going to physical therapy. He said it was awful. He said, I would get sick. It would hurt so much. But you know what kept him going? The hope that it wouldn't always be this way. The hope that one day it wouldn't hurt so much. That one day he would be able to walk without pain. And I saw him several years after the operation, and he was walking fine. That's the hope we have. That doesn't mean life will be pain-free. That doesn't mean there won't be things that hurt. But the hope we have is it won't always be this way. And why do we have that hope? Because of God's servant that's spoken of here in Isaiah 42. In the short term, it talked about Cyrus, the king of Persia. Ultimately, it looked to Jesus. So verses 5 through 7 describe the relationship that God the Father is going to have with God the Son. Here we go, verse 5. Thus says God the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and its offspring, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk in it. He's speaking now to the Son. Verse 6, I'm the Lord, I have called you in righteousness. I will hold you by the hand and watch over you. If you've been with us in Luke, you see Jesus keeps slipping off to pray. Why? Because he wants to be with the Father. He's been with him from eternity past, but for 30 years he stepped into our world. And he wanted to connect with him over and over again. He did nothing without the Father's approval, and they maintain this relationship. Middle of verse 6, he says, well, I will appoint you as a covenant to the people. The people is the people of Israel. Jesus is going to be the one to bring rebellious Israel back to God. The New Testament speaks that God is going to work again in the end times uniquely through Israel. I'm not sure exactly what that's going to look like, but God is not done with Israel. But this wayward people, Jesus is going to bring them back. One fear of every parent is you're in a grocery store, you're in a department store, it's busy, and your four-year-old child gets separated from you. Where is he? How do you feel about the friend or the person who recognizes that, finds your child, and brings them back to you? That's what Jesus is going to do with Israel, bringing them back to God. So Jesus will have a ministry to Israel, but he'll also have a ministry to the Gentile world. And, end of verse 7, as a light to the nations. That is talking about the Gentiles. Now before Jesus, the Gentiles were doing all kinds of crazy stuff to try and please God. They had a God of fertility and the God of the weather and the God of the rain and the God of this. And you made all these sacrifices. You give up all this stuff, sometimes even as extreme as child sacrifice. All kind of crazy. And Jesus said, you know, it's not that complicated. I'm the way to God. He wants to know that God's right there at your disposal. So the first time I was outside the U.S., I was on a mission trip in Istanbul, Turkey, 1986 to 88. And we would eat our dinners out. We would go over to the touristy areas, the Blue Mosque and St. Sophia, to try and meet English speakers. And there were plenty of places to eat over there. But breakfast and lunch, we were kind of scrambling. We didn't know the area. Nobody spoke English. Found a little bread here, a little there. And then one of the full-time staff said, really? There's a fresh market within 5 minutes of your apartment. Really? Where? I'll come over and I'll show you. And so that's what he did. And sure enough, you went down the stairs, down this alley, turned right, and there it was. Well, that solved our problem for the rest. No more problems with breakfast the rest of the summer. No more problems with lunch. It was right there, but we didn't know it. We were living and kind of starving. Well, that's how it's been with God. You're doing all this kind of crazy stuff, and God's right here. And Jesus makes him know. verse 7, kind of the confirmation of who Jesus will be, it says to open blind eyes, to bring prisoners from the dungeon and those who dwell in darkness from the prison. You talking literal or spiritual? I'm talking both. When Jesus was on earth with the blind person, he gave the word and they got their sight back. The person who was with a fever, Jesus spoke and the fever was gone. The person who was demon-possessed, trapped, Jesus spoke the word and they were set free. Now, sadly, many people only saw that reality. They wanted the quick fix now. They didn't look beyond to say this God can handle life into eternity. Everybody who's freed, everybody who's healed, gets sick again and dies. What then? Jesus is the one that can solve those issues in reconnecting us with God and giving us hope. So why is God writing this? Why is God saying this to the people 700 years before Jesus was born and to us? Because we got the same issue. We look for life outside of God, and that's what they were doing. Look at verse 8. I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another, nor my praise to graven images. These people were bowing down to idols, and God said, why are you doing that? And we don't bow to idols, but we look for life in other places, like material things. And what happens is the material things end up owning us. We can't get enough. I remember when I was a kid, new album. Might even be the greatest hits. This album will make me happy forever. No, within a month, I wanted another one because I got tired of that one. Stuff will only entrap you if you make it a god. Marriage is a great thing designed by God. But in the little marriage counseling I do, the number one issue is people have unrealistic expectations of their spouse. This person is not going to meet your ultimate need. Jesus is. And you put the needs that Jesus is supposed to meet on that person, you're going to be frustrated with them. You're going to be disappointed. So God's warning against worshiping false gods. They promise life, but they never do. Why should the people listen to God? Verse 9. Behold, the former things have come to pass. Look, I have told you in the past what's going to happen. Now I declare new things. And what's he declaring? It's 700 years before Jesus was born. He said, in 100 years, you're going to go into captivity. It's going to be 70 years. At some point, I'm going to raise up a new leader. Persia's going to take over, and I'm going to name him, and it's going to be Cyrus. I'm telling you that. I'm the one who knows. Now I declare new things. Before they spring forth, I proclaim them to you. So Isaiah's looking 150 years ahead and calling his shot. There's going to be a change of world power. It's going to go from Babylon to Persia. And that ruler, and he names him in Isaiah 45, Cyrus, 150 years before it happened, will issue a decree that allows you to go back. And that's what happened in 538 BC. So let me see if I can bring it home this way. We just had some elections in 2024. So I want to see if anybody would like to guess who will be elected president in 2044 in this country. Anybody want to make a guess at that? No, you want to make a guess at that? No, I'm going to pass on that. Well, that's absurd, right? I mean, 20 years, we don't know. Who's got? How about 2064? Anybody got that? That person may not have been born yet. Hey, listen, God's looking 150 years ahead, and he's calling his shot. Now, if you get on Google and you type in who wrote Isaiah, Google's going to probably tell you it was written in stages. There was the first part, and then there was the part after Cyrus, because there's no way somebody could predict that 150 years beforehand. Somebody had to write afterwards and write that back in. Well, I would say that depends on your view of God, doesn't it? See, I think my God can tell his prophet what's going to happen 150 years ahead. I don't think that's any big deal for God. So no, I don't think there were multiple writers of Isaiah. I think there was one. Listen, if I've got the book you wrote here, and I'm in chapter 2, and you tell me what happens in chapter 16, that ain't going to surprise me. You wrote the book, right? You're outside the time frame of the book. Do you understand? God's outside the time frame of our world. So to say what's going to happen back then or in the future, that's no thing. And God's saying, why would you trust some image when you could trust me. So what's my point here? What's the hope we have? This servant that was predicted 700 years before the fact, he lives with us. John 14, 18 and 19. Jesus says this right before he went to the cross. He says, I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you. I will live in your heart. After a little while, he resurrects and ascends into heaven. The world will no longer see me, but you will. You'll see me because I live, you will live also. There's our hope. The catalyst of returning life, God's life-giving order, resides in our heart. Let me refer to our devotional. Jonathan Holmes wrote a two-page thing entitled Bend Toward the Light. He said, my plants were drooping. It was winter. So I decided to pull up the shade. It seemed the plants perked up and they began to bend toward the light. Well, why would they do that? The light is where they get life. What are you bending towards this Christmas season to get life? Getting the right present? Giving the right present? Pulling off the perfect Christmas dinner? Are you bending towards the hope that your family doesn't blow up at Christmas dinner? What are you bending toward to give you life? Isaiah, writing 700 years before Jesus was born, is saying, you ought to bend towards the servant, the one that God talked about from eternity past that would come and give life and give hope. See, we can have the firm, the stubborn hope that the couple talked about when they didn't know the fate of their child. We can say, hope in God doesn't disappoint. Goodness of God never changes, regardless of outcome, because of Jesus. Where is your hope this Christmas? Any Star Wars fans here? Any Star Wars? Thank you. Appreciate that, being honest. Eighth installment of Star Wars. Kylo Ren has flipped to the dark side. And he's gone after the rebellion. And he comes to the Sith Lord Snoke. And he says, I've done it. I've crushed the resistance. And Snoke says, no, you haven't. And I'm going to quote here what he says. Skywalker lives. The seed of the Jedi lives. As long as he does, hope lives. You haven't crushed the rebellion. You haven't taken away the hope. Skywalker lives, and as long as he does, hope lives. And we still got a rebellion on our hand. You understand Jesus lives? And there's an enemy he wants to destroy, but Jesus lives. Hope doesn't end. We got hope on our hands because Jesus lives. One more time, let me ask and answer our question. What's the hope of Christmas? Christmas signals the start of the reinstatement of God's life-giving order. Would you pray with me? Our Father in heaven, we're grateful for this truth, that Jesus came and he's the catalyst. He started the reinstatement of your life-giving order. And Lord, we take hope, we take heart that it won't always be like this, because he's coming back one day to restore the world the way you designed it. Father, thank you. In the meantime, that hope lives in our heart. The resurrected Lord lives in our heart. Thank you for the hope that Christmas promises. Pray in your name. Amen.